Rabbi Alex Israel, Sunday morning, December 11th, Jewish violence, empowerment or endangerment.
So thank you very, very much to everybody who's involved here. David Jacobovitz, Bernie Stahl, and I hear it's Bernie's birthday. I have to get that apparently on the...
Matis made that up.
I think it must have been fun to teach you in high school.
we'll find out when I get there.
I've been asked to mention that this shiur has been generously sponsored by Lila and George Lowell in memory of Moshe Ben Pinchas Gelbertzal, Shari and Bernie Stoll, Debbie and Mark Teicher in memory of Debbie's parents, Bia and Moshe Lovinger, Zichronom Libracha. Thank you very, very much to the community for having me. It's a delight to be here, and I hope we'll have the opportunity to open this topic up. The topic of Shechem and the act of Shimon and Levi here. Of course, this is I want to mention the title that I gave, right, which was this idea of Jewish power. It's dangerous because I think that I'm even going to throw this out not just at the end but at the beginning. Baruch Hashem, we live in an age where we have Medina Israel, and we are empowered. I stood at my son's tekes at the Kotel a few months ago, and that's exactly what the Mufakadim turned around and said. They said, you're standing here at the Kotel, a whole battalion of Givati soldiers, and how many Jews throughout 2,000 years of Galut would have, Tishkach Yimini would have given their right arm to have such a situation? And indeed, this is true. And yet, I find myself being brought back to these topics all the time. Dafka because we have power, and dafka because sometimes we have to deal with the ethics of power, I think it's very important. Sometimes we're very delighted that we do have an army and ability to defend ourselves, but I think it obligates us to be able to try and finesse the moral questions. And in fact, since we haven't really had to deal with the halachot of war for many thousands of years, even in the Talmud Bavli, the sugyot, which deal with war, are not so sophisticated. And when the poskim of this generation, or the last generation, people like Rav Shlomo Goren and like Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who wrote Rav Goren's momentous work, Meshiv Milchama, where he talks about Shelot and Shuvot at war, and when they have to deal with questions of civilian casualties, they actually come back to this story. They come back to this story and try and start examining it from a halachic perspective, and trying to. It's not only us who have to look back to the Tanakh, but to look to the Tanakh in order to find certain answers. There are source sheets over there. So that's a little bit of an introduction. I want to just learn the parasha as a parasha, but then hopefully we'll make some contemporaneous comments towards the end, and we'll try and take it in that direction. I'm assuming that everybody's on the page and knows the parasha. We've read it every year, even though hopefully we'll take a closer look and hopefully observe some things that we haven't seen before. But let me start off with a sort of methodological question when it comes to Tanakh. When we look at a parasha in Tanakh, and we want to know what is the opinion of the Tanakh, or maybe I should say better, if it's Torah, what's the opinion of the Rabbanu Shel Olam to do? How do we morally judge what Shimon and Levi did in Shechem? How are we meant to be able to assess something? Now, sometimes the Tanakh gives us a absolute statement. It's relatively unusual. But I'll give you one very clear example. Even then, Chazal are able to say what they want to say. But, for example, in the story of David and Bathsheba, you have a statement, Vayira hadavar asher asa David be'inei Hashem. It tells us, Hashem didn't like it, he thought it was ra. So then you get an explicit statement. In other cases, you will have a different clue. There will be an onesh, right? There will be some sort of punishment, sometimes it's pronounced explicitly. And that might be the case of, example, I don't know, Moshe and the rock. Yeah, Moshe and the rock. So you will be able to figure out that this is something that Hashem is not happy about, because he says, you know, you're punished. Miriam, you know, but Tadaber, Aaron and Miriam. So you understand that something bad happened as a result, and you know there is displeasure. By the way, sometimes it's more oblique. It's a very interesting in the story of the Yosef story. After they sold Yosef, was there any sort of consequences? Was there any comeuppance? It's fascinating that the very next story is the story of Yehuda and Tamar. And Yehuda finds that Yehuda, the man who had sold Yosef down the river, finds, and I know the Tanakh has other reasons for their death, but finds that two of his sons died. Right. And how do I know that it was perceived by the family as a sign of divine displeasure? Because when they're thinking of taking Binyamin down to Egypt, Reuven makes what seems such an absurd statement, right? At Shnei Banai Tamit, you'll kill my two children if I lose Binyamin. I always thought, what a crazy idea. But I think that they perceived the death of Yehuda's two children as punishment for his role in the sale of Yosef, right?
That's got to be qualified.
What?
That's got to be qualified.
What do you mean?
Rashi and Ibn Ezra. The timing.
Okay, that's an interesting question about the timing. Okay, 100%. Even though I think it's, I think that's very much. By the way, there are lots of questions of timing there in the story, but I do think that that Reuven's suggestion comes out of a perception that within human actions there is displeasure. Here, we have a very, very difficult and thorny situation, because how exactly to assess the story is really very unclear. If you look at the end of the story, we might look for the statement of what happened, what is said. You can look in Pasuk Lamed in the Perek here, Perek Lamed Dalet, and it says there, Pasuk Lamed verse 30, Vayomer Yaakov el Shimon v'Levi, acharetem oti. We're going to come back to these pesukim in a few minutes. You have sullied me, lahavisheni b'yosheva aretz b'kanani v'prizi v'ani matei mispar. You have made me smell bad in the eyes of the locals, and I am small in number. V'nesfor alai v'hikuni v'nishmarati ani ubeiti. And they will wipe us out. Okay, which sounds interesting. Is this a moral critique?
No, it's a how strong am I at the moment?
Right, it's a sort of pragmatic statement. Okay, you know, we're going to look bad. What are the goyim going to think? They're all going to come, and they're going to be retributions. Right, we're not strong enough. Right, and but it certainly seems pragmatic, not moral. And they answer, "Hachazonaya set achotenu. You're going to treat our sister as a zona." What?
That could be also a practical thing, or it could be a moral thing.
Right, so it could be that they get the last moral statement. In other words, that's the way we're going to be treated. Right? You can't let us be pushed around. And you could actually say, you could, even if we're in danger, it would be wrong to do that. Because I'm willing to put my life in danger. As Yaakov, you say we're endangering ourselves, I'm willing to put ourselves in danger, because it would be irresponsible and immoral to put our sister in this situation. That could be one argument. It could be a moral statement. Or it could be, as you say correctly, a pragmatic statement, right? You know what? Dad, you think that we're going to be more vulnerable now? No. Now they're going to be terrified of us, right? The funny thing in the parasha is that they get the last word. That sort of ringing statement. You might say, in which case, they are vindicated. And if I want to vindicate them even more, right, I would look to just below this, Pasuk Hay in the very next Perek. Perek Lamed Hay, Pasuk Hay. Vayisa'u vayichitat Elohim ala arim asher svivotehem v'lo radfu acharei b'nei Yaakov. In other words, God backs them up, right? But of course, we all know that it's more complicated. Yes?
Well, they get the last word here, but then in the Vayichay,
very good.
Really
So source number two, Vayechi. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
you obviously got the notes for the shir. In Vayechi, Yaakov curses their anger. We're going to, and this is one of the classic questions, why does Yaakov issue a pragmatic reproof at the time? But of course, here he talks about Shimon Velevi Achi claim Hamas Mecherot Tehem B'Salam Al Tavon Ashi B'Kalam Al Techad Fodi. I will, my spirit will not be united. Aurora panki az ve'evra tamki kashata. A curse here. Something very, very fierce. And we are in two minds about exactly how to assess the situation here. Is should we hear the last word as Shimon Levi's word, vindicating their action, or Yaakov's words of cursing? There seems to be some sort of ambiguity.
Isn't there a reference here, though, underneath to the original intent to kill Yosef? Was it not Shimon and Levi who were ready to kill him?
So first of all, when it's never said explicitly in the psukim, it's said, but we'll go in that direction. According to, we'll try and resolve it in one direction, possibly like that. But the Rishonim as well debate and discuss this topic. If you look here in source 3a. The Rambam says, he's talking about Shiva, Mitzvot, B'nai Noach, and he says, Ketzad Mesuvim Heim Al Adinim, how do we see that non-Jewish nations are commanded with, Dinim means setting up a system of law, a law enforcement, and he says, Chayavim Lo Shiv Dayanim B'Shoftim B'Chol Pelach U'Pelach, they have to put a legal system in line into every single region, Ladun b'sheish mitzvot elu, to judge on the six of the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. This is the seventh. Olaz hir et ha'am, uven Noach sh'avar l'acham yishev mitzvot elu yihareg b'sayit. Anyone who is over on sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach, a non-Jew, will suffer the penalty of death. And now he adds, u'mipnei ze nitchayvu kol ba'lei shchem hariga. And because of this, all the people in Shechem were sentenced to death. Shehari Shechem gazal, v'heim ra'u, v'yadu v'lo danu. They saw he did it in a public space. He, I don't know, came riding along on his steed and swept her up and raped her in the public square, or God knows what. And they saw it was known, nobody challenged their leader. And, you know, therefore they're all culpable, right? You have to put your leaders in their place. So he's guilty, the town is guilty, and all of that. The Ramban, and maybe I should have put the lines in which the Ramban actually takes issue with the Ramban does not like at all this opinion of the Ramban. He says, sorry, I didn't bring the exact, I had so much on the sheet anyway, it was getting a bit too much. The Ramban says to the Rambam, very nice try, Rambam, but it's not true. He says, if Bnei Yaakov, who made them Sarv Shofet, who decided that they should be responsible for enforcing the enforcement of Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, he says, if it was true that Bnei Yaakov were responsible for doing that, then, well, there are lots of idolatrous nations throughout Canaan. Should they go and just kill people left, right, and center? And he disagrees. He says, who asked them to do it? He doesn't see any legal or moral justification in what they did. And in fact, what he says is, here I'll read a few lines here. Ki amir tshuva, meaning at the bottom of page 2, ki amir mahaita, the trickery was, ba'omram lihimolehem kol zachar, ki chashu she lo yasu ken b'nei ha'ir, their trickery was that they offered the option of circumcision because they thought they would never go with it. If they'd listened to their leader, they would enter on the third day, and they'd simply kidnap her back. Okay, they would take Dina back. In fact, what he says the legal thing to do would be to do the trick, and this is what Yaakov signed off on, to get them all to do Brit Milah. When they were in a state of you know, they were physically compromised beyond Mashlishi, and they couldn't really fight back. They would come, I assume, armed, but they would come in order to come back and seize Dina. And it says, he says very, very powerfully here, he says, Hey Ratsu Lina Kemen. They wanted to take vengeance. Maybe Yaakov's anger was that they killed the men of the city who did not sin. In other words, according to the Ramban, only Shechem was culpable, the rapist himself, and everybody else should not have been murdered. And this was indeed a moral problem, and this is why Yaakov curses them. So, what I'm saying is very difficult to know how exactly to assess this story, because there are different cues. There are different cues, but we see the statement of the brother hanging there. Hachazonaya set achotenu vayichi tat Elokim. Hakadosh Baruch Hu backs them. On the other hand, we've got Yaakov's curse. You know, what are we exactly going to do about that? Even the Rishonim, right? It's not, there's not a clear view. And, you know, there aren't, you know, we're talking about Rambam, you know, these are the people we rely on for our Parshanut. Things are very complex. Yes?
But couldn't it also be that if it's an overreaction on their part, that it's responding to Yaakov's underreaction in Pasuk Hey, Vechrish Yaakov Ad Boam, which is wise counsel, that you want to take counsel together with your fighters, but at the same time, it is an underreaction.
Okay. By the way, that doesn't help us with the moral problem. Okay?
Yeah.
Well, what I would like to do is I want to go back to the story and look at certain cues in the story and certain words in the story in order to be able to try and see whether the story itself has any particular clues. But maybe we'll start with this point. Yaakov, throughout the story, remains peculiarly passive. Really passive. Okay? And it's a really big question about how to assess Yaakov's action. We have, if we go back to the actual text on page 1, okay? I want to even start earlier than that, but since you mentioned it, if we look at Pasuk Hey, the Yaakov Shamaki Timei et Dina Bito. I think that is a weighted statement. Timei et Dina Bito means that this was an act which is considered to be morally reprehensible. I'm in Pasuk Hey, right? Uvanava Yuit Mikneu, Vecharish Yaakov Ad Boam. Yaakov remains silent till they come home. And when they do, but before they do, it seems like by Yetzei Chamor Avishchem El Yaakov Ledaberito, Uvene Yaakov Bao Min HaSadek Shema V'yitatzvu Anashim V'yichar Lahem. This stage, by the way, it's not V'yichar Af, which means anger. V'yichar means they are upset, they're depressed, they're disturbed. Ki Nevala Asa B'Yisrael Lishkavet Bat Yaakov V'chein Lo Yaseh. The Tanakh is, you know, you have to feel the pulse of Tanakh, right? That's what we do from a literary perspective. And I think you're feeling that the pulse is, it's very clear when we read Pasuk Hey, Vav, Zayin, that the Tanakh makes no bones about it. This is an unspeakable travesty. This is a terrible thing to do. By the way, Nevala Asa B'Yisrael is a fascinating phrase, because it's the first time the family are called Israel. This is Perek Lamed Dalet. In Perek Lamed Gimel, Yaakov fights with the angel and gets his name chained by the angel. The name is ratified only in the next Perek, Lamed Hey, when he goes up to Beit El. Already the Tanakh, the objective narrator of the Tanakh, is referring to the family as Nevala Sab Israel, as if to say, we're a nation, we're not just a family. By the way, that is the root of the Shita of the Maharal in this Parsha, where the Maharal says it is absolutely morally fine for whatever Shimon HaLevi did, anything at all, because he says it is war. In the international law, he says, you can, Maharal, he says you can declare, he says it is legal to declare war. He wants to claim there's no Geneva Convention. He says in war, you know, in civil life, right, if you pick up a gun and you shoot somebody in the street, you're culpable. In war, you get a medal, right? So he says, war has a totally different laws as regards, you know, all sorts of things. He doesn't think there are any moral, limits in terms of war, not too many. And therefore, he actually wants to say in the Balasabi, look, they're a nation, it's war, and now, you know, you fight to the death, you fight to till you vanquish them.
Yeah, up until this time, the kings have taken whoever they wanted to take, right? They took Sarah, right? And Rivka. So all of a sudden here, it's told this is not to be done, but before it was done, if they were not the daughters, right? They were married. But also Hashem intervened. So this is, right? This is right. Different.
So it could be that the issue is one of marriage, okay? That's true. In other words, a married woman is very, very different from a single girl. It's a good point, but maybe that's, you know, on the other hand, even Avram himself, right? By the way, the story of Avimelech, Avimelech says, you know, you almost brought on me, so they had this sense that it was wrong, even though they were doing it.
Something's happening, right? That's obviously different.
All right, so let's take a look again. We're trying to feel the part. We've seen the act is terrible. But I even want to go back to the beginning of the story, because there are some interesting things here. On the one hand, let's start from the beginning. Anybody want to think about what that introduction might give us? I mean, I know what Rashi says.
Right. He was criticized for going out.
Right, so Rashi goes down and says... Rashi wants to point out that Dina bat Leah bat Teitzei, that you see that she is Dina, the daughter of Leah, says Yatzanitz, but Yatzanitz, this is not a particularly popular Rashi in feminist circles, right? Kol kavuda la melech pnima, right? That she went out sexually in the story of the Dudaim, and that Dina went out sexually. I have to be honest, from the perspective of the story, I don't really see this. You don't see any indication that he went out provocatively. If there was, maybe there'd be another way to say it. Difficult to find. Could we come up with a difference, with a reading less in explanation of why it might say Dina bat Leah she yalda li Yaakov? So Dina bat Leah, right? What do we have? That might explain why we dafka have Shimon and Levi intervening, right? Because you see later on that it says, where's the passage? Later on it says in Pasuk Chachay, Vayichu Shnei Bnei Yaakov, Shimon v'Levi Achei Dina. In other words, to show us that she is Bat Leah, and therefore it's the Leah boys who are going to take this under her. You know what?
There's four others.
There are four others, but they were the most enthusiastic. You might say something else, yeah.
Also, back to the point that I made before about Sarah and Rivka, she's the first one that's born of this special family, right? The others were from Haran or
right.
Some other parent. It's possible that they're talking about holiness in some way.
Holiness? Oh, it could be. Asher Yaldal Yaakov. By the way, if you want to make it more sinister, and something you mentioned already, Yaakov's silence, we see how agitated Yaakov is about Yosef and Binyamin. Yaakov's silence here is very peculiar. Is it because it's Dinah bat Leah? Could we say that there are Yaakov's favorites, right? He seems to be inactive, seems not to do very much, right? I don't know. I always wondered to myself this strange Dinah bat Leah asher yaldah Yaakov, not Dinah bat Yaakov asher yaldah Leah, or something like that. That it's distancing her from Yaakov, and it's pushing, and it's mentioning that she's close to Leah. I think that maybe if we want to read very little in, right, you know, you might want to say this is already explaining that she's close to the Leah faction, but Yaakov is not quite on board. I don't know. I'm not trying to be critical of Yaakov, I'm just trying to, we know there is this family, these family favorites, right, here.
But if you did a thought experiment, it took out that phrase,
okay,
right, and just said, the teitzei lekrot benot, Dina, the growth of the note ha'aretz, we then read into it that it was because it was Dina, and it was because of Leah. So here it's just explicitly saying it. I mean,
right.
You could argue the opposite.
You're right. By the way, one of the reasons why I think Rashi's more problematic is she went out provocatively. It says Lirot Bivnot Ha'aretz. It doesn't say Lirot Bivnei Ha'aretz.
Right.
She's looking at a poor girl. She's living with 12 boys. You know, like, You know, he needs to find some girlfriends,
groups.
Right?
She went to groups.
She's not exactly the right help, but I was read as she wanted to be seen amongst the others. So she really, basically, she wanted to join that cover, and that's how she got, that's when she comes sore, because she's basically
mixing with the local.
Mixing with local girls. So basically, she's in that population to be picked up for a wife, and she was looking for.
Parenthetically, I don't want to take you off too far, but just going to Yaakov and Leah, do we have any proof that Yaakov actually disliked or hated Leah, or was it simply that he favored Rachel?
It's a machlokas rishonim on the pasuk Vayehav gamet Rachel mileah, right? It says, "Vayehav gamet Rachel mileah." We know that Leah subjectively felt, right? She says, the parsha we just read, for example, Shimon, because Hashem has seen ki snu'a anochi. That's her subjective feelings. We don't know about Yaakov. It says, "Vayehav gam et Rachel mileah." So here there's a discussion. I think it's Rashi who says he loved both of them, but loved Rachel more. Okay, the Ramban says he hated Leah. At least initially, it seems like, you know, the first one she calls Reuven, right? Ki ra'a Hashem ba'oni, God has seen my suffering. Shimon ki snu'a anochi. Levi hapam yilavei shielai. Maybe my husband will go for a walk with me. Yehuda hapam odet Hashem. Right. Now here, what happened with Yehuda? Right? It's clear the first three she felt hated. The Ramban says, why did she feel hated? Because he hated her. Why did he hate her? She tricked him, right? He said the whole night he was pretending. He said, you couldn't have said something. Maybe I'd have married you anyway. Maybe whatever. You couldn't have been honest with me. And he couldn't get over that hurt. And he really hated her, right? So what happened with Yehuda? So now there are two options. Either by Yehuda, Hatamoreh Hashem, she said, all right, I've got a terrible marriage, but I've got lovely kids. And by the time she had a fourth kid, she says, oh great, you know, I'm an Eim Habanim Smecha, but I don't have a great marriage. And she'd like come to terms with it. Hapam Odeh Hashem. Option B, that by the time her fourth kid came around, Yaakov was helping out with the kids, you know. Yaakov was more spending more time with her because pushing the kids on the swing while she's pushing on the other swing. They actually had some nice conversations, right? She's actually feeling the relationship is warming up, right? Dafka because she is the mother of his children. So we don't really know, right? There are, you know, it's interesting. Leah Dafka, I always find it fascinating that we all remember. Sorry, this really is a bit off the point, but. We always remember that Rachel is ifat Torah, ifat Moreh, but Leah has Enei Leah Rakot. Now, it's not clear what Rakot means, but Rashi always has that. We always remember the Rashi, right, that she was crying. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So it's very interesting that our first image of Leah is crying and Rachel is beautiful. What's our perpetual image of which one is crying perpetually? Rachel. Right? It's very interesting that Rachel, right, you have this love, but who's buried with Yaakov? Leah. And Rachel is buried sort of like in limbo. It's actually very interesting to sort of switch between these two sisters, where Leah somehow ends up getting into a more stable position, and Rachel remains in an unstable position, which is just it's fascinating.
Going to the Ramban, I don't want to belabor the point. It's very unflattering to Yaakov that he should harbor such a hate. It was her father who forced her to do it, so.
Yeah,
that she heard.
There's also guilt. A lot of everything that Yaakov is doing, Parshas Vayetzin, Vayishlach, people argue that it has to do with guilt. So part of the hatred of Leah could be guilt of stealing the Bechorah.
Right. Okay, so now we're really in Parshas Vayetzin, not here. So you're going to excuse me. I'm going to cut. I'm going to make a cut. I wanted to actually get. We got stuck on Pasuk Aleph, but I want to actually get Pasuk Bet. Because Pasuk Bet, Vayarota Shechem ben Chamor Achivin Nesiaretz Vayikachota Vayishkavota Vayaneha. Very strong language. It doesn't say Vayishkav Ita. He lies with her, but Vayishkav Ota is violent, right? She is an object, and Vayaneha, he raped her. There's no bones about that, right? And therefore, this would definitely seem to be very problematic. And then we see a bit of a surprise. Vatidbak nafsho b'dina b'Yaakov b'yehav atanara v'yidaber alev hanara. He suddenly falls in love with her. Right? Now, I'm not going to condone his actions at all. In fact, I think he raped her, and worse than that, he raped her and then abducted her. He doesn't let her go home. Right? I even want to say something more than that. If we keep reading through, he then, because he loves her, and of course they have to mention that he loves her, because otherwise, I mean, by the way, the story which is parallel to this story in Tanakh is, of course, another story, right, of a rape, which is Amnon and Tamar. Right? Amnon and Tamar. And there we have a story where it uses exactly the same phrase. There it actually says, Vayaneha Vayishkavima, the other way. Right? It's a very interesting story because there also the father remains silent. Right? And it results in an act of violence where a brother avenges, right, the death. But if we go back to the Ramban, who does Amnon kill? Sorry, who does Avshalom kill?
Amnon.
Only Amnon. Only the perpetrator. Not anybody else. Right? One interesting thing in that story, of course, is that the minute Amnon does the rape,
he throws her out the room.
Right? He throws her out the room. Now, if that would happen in this story, Dina would be back home. Right? And that's not the way. It arouses his affections for her, and the storyline happens that he keeps her, he abducts her, he keeps her there, and now he goes out to Yaakov, and he says to his father, get me this girl for a wife, and asks his father to go and talk to Yaakov. Now, here's the fascinating thing. It says that Yaakov heard that she had been defiled. How did he hear? So I think there are two options, right? The Abarbanel says, for example, she wouldn't have gone alone into the village, into the town. She had a few assistants with her, a few of their servants, maidservants, what have you, and they ran back and told him. Right? Or the other option is they had a few allies in the city of Shechem who came back and said, did you hear what happened to Dina? Right? But one of the interesting things that I think is when Pasuk Vav, Vayetzei Chamor Avi Shechem El Yaakov Ledaber Ito, Vene Yaakov Bal Min HaSadeh, etc., Pasuk Chet, Vayidaber Chamor Itam, Chamor says, Shechem Beni Chashka Nafsho B'Vitchem, my son Shechem loves your daughter. He saw her in the market, he likes her. Tnul wal na ota lo leisha, v'itchatnu otanu benote. What's missing here? An acknowledgement. An apology, right? Do you think he assumed that Yaakov hadn't heard?
Or Hamor didn't know about it.
That's another possibility. That Hamor didn't know, although I find that difficult to believe, right? I'm sure a rape in the town would be no. You know, if you go back to the laws of rape in the Torah, it says, Im basadeh, you might say, if there's a rape basadeh, nobody will know about it. But if it's ba'ir, the assumption is people do know about it, right?
But not every society can have a rape.
Right. But I understand that, but it still might be that he would have heard, right? But here you see that, by the way, the way he's described in the Pasuk Bet is, Shechem ben Chamor hachivi nasi ha'aret. He clearly thought he could get his way with her because he is the crown prince and he could do whatever he wants. I certainly think the beginning of the story, right, seems to give us the indication, Ashetimei nevala sabi Yisrael, this is terrible and he's abusing his power and this is a very bad thing. And I even think he tries to jump the gun to try and make a deal. On the other hand, right, we're trying to look at the Tanakh commentary here. On the other hand, if I do go back to the story of rape in the Torah, do you remember what happens if you are in a situation where a man rapes a woman who is not a Na'aram or Asa, she's not betrothed, what does he do?
He marries her,
right? What does it say? It's very interesting, right? It says, right? If he does, then, v'natana isha shochev imah l'avi anara chemishim kesef. He gives her father 50 kesef. Velot Yelisha shall be his wife. Tachar Asher Ina, because he raped her, Ina, lo yuchal shalcha kol yam. Suddenly when you read that, and now you see, what does he say? Tanan kachliyata elda hazot l'isha. And his father goes to negotiate with her father. And when he sees that Yaakov's not apparently warming up to this idea because they said, we'll marry you and you'll marry us, Pasuk Tet, right? Suddenly, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayomer Shechem el Avia velachea. She turns around to her father and to her brother and says, Harbu alai, sorry, Emsachem benechem vashet tomru elai etain. Whatever you ask me, I will give. Harbu alai ma'od mohar umatan betna kashet tomru elai utnuni etana ara leisha. I just want to marry her. In other words, right, it could well be that a rape has happened, but at least Shechem is doing the honorable thing. Right? I mean, I'm not talking about this covenantally. We don't intermarry with the local tribes. There are lots of covenantal questions, but from a moral... What?
Nobody
asked Dina.
She's
true.
7 years old, remember?
Well, I'm not sure she's 7 years old. depends how you work according to the... Rav Meidan has a crazy theory about the timing
so
of this story. Okay, so maybe they got it from each other. I don't know who got it from who.
In Pasuk Vav, do you read a pregnant silence between Chamor and Yaakov? That there's just, with the sons not there, there should have been some kind of discussion, but
right.
We hear nothing about it. It's both are passive until
right.
The sons show up.
I think he waits for his sons to be there, and notice he doesn't speak. Right? Some of the Mefarshim say it just was not his kavod after this great insulting act that he should not speak. Although it is strange, you'd think the son would talk to the son and the father would talk to the father, you know, the equal rank. Yaakov is very perplexingly quiet until the last line of the story. Right? What I basically said until now, I think that the text of the rape is very violent. I think that in many ways Shechem feels entitled. And Shechem and Chamor are opportunistic. And therefore, I think there's definitely a lot in the text which seems to indicate that this is absolutely awful. On the other hand, even within the laws of the Torah, and I'm not necessarily claiming that the laws of Devarim need to apply to Sefer Bereishit and to Shechem, but it does seem to maybe reflect some sort of cultural norms. Admittedly, they have not acknowledged the rape. And that might be the big key problem here, because it's one thing if they seem to be giving a marriage proposal without acknowledging that any act of violence came along. Right? And I think that's the most terrible thing. On the other hand, would we justify the acts of Shimon and Levi, right? Even from the text. One of the key phrases, which I think is relevant, is, of course, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Ve'yanu v'nei Yaakov et Shechem et Chamor aviv b'mirma. Right? Mirma does not have a positive ring to it. Right? Mirma, you know, we Lama Rinitani says Yaakov to Lavan after the story with Rachel and Leah. Okay, Ba Achicha Ba Mirma VeYikach Et Birchatecha says Yaakov to says Yitzchak to Esav. Mirma is not a positive thing. Netzor LeShoncha Meira Usvatecha Medaber Mirma. Mirma is a parallel to the word Ra. Right, I know that in the case of Yaakov stealing the brachot. Anybody remember what Rashi says? Ba achicha b'mirma. So Rashi says, b'chochma. that Yaakov was clever, he wasn't deceitful. But I've got to be honest. I actually was not sure about this, and before I davened Shacharis, went into the Bet Midrash to look up the word mirma in the concordance. So I was thinking about this on the way. Maybe there are places where mirma actually means chochma. Overwhelmingly, it has really negative connotations. Okay, so when I'm looking, if I'm looking for cues in the text, how does the Tanakh itself look at this? That line that they talk to them in Mirma, right, is, you know, very problematic. But there's one other thing here which is problematic in the text, and that is what you see towards the end of the story. Pasuk Chaf Hei. I'm sorry, I'm rushing a little bit because we've got a lot of material. You know, the way to really do this is to have to do a 2-hour share and to really sit and learn every single line. But if you look here, it was on the third day when they were hurting. They came secure to the city. Bnei Yaakov ba'ala chalalim vayavozo ha'ira shitimu achotam. The children of Yaakov came on the bodies and they looted the city which had defiled their sister. Et sonam, vet bekaram, their sheep, their cattle, vet chamoreihem, their donkeys, vet asheba'ir, vet asheba'sadeh lakachu, vet kol chaylam, vet kol tapam, Disproportionate. What, even before I get to evaluating it, you hear the language, right?
Yeah.
It's the language is you know, etzonam ve bekaram ve chamorihem ve rasheba ir ve rasheba sadeh ve what's going on here, right? And many people point to this and say, you know, maybe if they'd come and kill Shechem and Chamor, whoever it is, Mela. But it sounds like the language here seems to be pushing us over the edge. Now, is there anywhere else where we see this sort of language? So I put here in source number 8, that it's the language of Ir HaNidachat. Right? The same language as Ir HaNidachat. If you see on the right hand side, you see Bereishit Peret Lamed Hei. And if you look on the left hand side, for example, Vayakol Shama or Kashamam, you see Kishishma Bacharecha Naistaha Toiva Hazot Yisrael. Here it doesn't say Toiva, it says Nevala, right? Which is similar. And we have interestingly other language, Yatsu or Yoshvei Ram, right? The same thing. Yotzei Shar Iro. There's the idea of a condemned city who have done a terrible act. In one case it's Avodah Zarah, in this case it is Gilui Arayot. And they kill them the fichara, right?
But there's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
For an iridachas, everything is chayrim and asur bana. Here, after if you're looking for moral instead of practical, you want to kill everybody. That's one thing. But unlike you know what parallel comes to mind? Uvabizam lo shalach, lo shalach.
Okay. Very good. Okay.
Thank
you.
You just took me.
You just took the next 7 minutes out of the shiur. Good.
We saved
some time. No, you don't say sorry. That's very good. In other words, what I was going to say, I'll take it slow. Sorry. Just give me a minute. What I wanted to say was there seems to be a parallel to Ir HaNidachat, right? And you see the same sort of phrase. Ir HaNidachat, again, just want to make sure that everybody's on the page. It's a city which worships Avodah Zarah, and because it is a city and the whole city have gone sour, we kill the whole city. Right? Morally, very problematic, so much so that there are certain statements in Chazal which claim this never really happened historically. But if you look at the language, it's very similar. Hachare mota, condemn it. I'm looking in the bottom left corner. Ved behem talafi chare, ved kol shlala, tikbots el toch ruchova, vasarfta ba'eshita ir, ved kol shlala, kalil, Hashem lecha, v'ayta tel olam, lo tibaneo. But then we have the final line. V'lo yibat biyadcha mu'umat nafcheren. Nothing should be taken from the chere. Right? Don't take anything because it is sort of holy. It is for God, because you're doing it as a divine action. You don't take anything. Now, yeah, well, there's another case where also we didn't take anything from the spoils. We destroyed a city, we didn't take anything. And that is Yericho. I put it in source 10 here. And there, very interesting, you also, Pasuk Chafalof, Ve'achrimet kol asher ba'ir, me'ish, v'adisha, minar, v'adzakein, v'adshor, v'seh, v'chamor, lefichareh, v'yisarfu ba'ish. And something actually very interesting here is that somebody did take. Remember? His name was Achan. And he did take. And it says in Pasuk Yudchet here, Barak atem shimru mena cherem, pentacharimu. It's a very interesting word. If you get into the cherem, the holy thing, pentacharimu means the opposite, lest you overstep the law. V'lakachta mina cherem, v'samtem machane Yisrael cherem. Three times in the same Pasuk, the word cherem meaning different things. Am Yisrael will be destroyed. Va'achartem oto. And you will bring Am Yisrael down. And of course, in the next perek, Vayom Yeshua, he says to Achan, who took from the spoils, Ma'achartanu yarchacha Hashem. Right? And they take Achan out and they bury him in a place called Emek Achor. Is it a coincidence that Yaakov says in this story, Achartem oti? In other words, when you engage in a divine act against a city, right? You are meant to. If this is really leman Hashem, if it's really for the sake of God, right? You don't despoil the city and take everything and put it in your own pockets. If it's a moral action for God, you take it for God. You burn it all. You don't take any yourself. That was what they were meant to do in Yericho. That was, and when somebody transgresses, it's called achartem, right? And here, what I'm saying is that maybe. Like if we go with the Ramban, they should have killed Shechem. They could have killed Shechem. Maybe killed Chamor. Kill everybody. Who knows? To take the spoils? Yes.
In terms of Ir HaNidachas, according to Chazal, as you said, it never happened. So, okay, whatever. Is it possible that sometimes you have certain things that the other person deserved it, but you don't do it, like Ayin Tachas Ayin? The person deserves to have his eye out, but you don't actually do it. So it's possible that, in a certain sense, Anshei Shechem, what they deserved was perhaps what the Rambam says, but you don't actually do something like that. In terms of actually doing it, then you go according to the Ramban.
It could be. And there are, by the way, many, many things. I once heard a wonderful shir by Rav Yoav Nun, where he wanted to claim that there are many examples in Sefer Devarim where there's actually almost like a commentary on Sefer Bereishit saying sort of don't do this, right? I'll give you an example. Lo takim lecha matzeva, this week's Parsha Shavua. Lo takim lecha matzeva asher saneh Hashem Elokech. Rashi says, what do you mean asher saneh? You liked it when Yaakov did it, right? Yaakov did it, but you shouldn't do it, right? Or when you have shtei nashim, achat ahuva, achat snoa, also Parsha Shavua, right? You have a Rachel, you have a Leah, right? Lo yabaker et ben ahuva al pnei haksnoa habachor. In other words, don't give Yosef a coat of many colors because it's going to have a lot of trouble, right? That was the way Rav Yoav wanted to read it. That is almost saying there are things to learn from the Avot and there are things not to learn from the Avot, right? It would be very interesting if Sefer Devarim was sort of like talking about a moral right, but you know, or maybe being mataken. Don't think that what Shimon and Levi did was okay. And if you ever have to be in this situation, don't take anything from the spoils or whatever it would be. I think there's something to talk about there. What I'm trying to say is, let me just try and explain how we've built the shir so far. I said it's very difficult to know. There's no explicit statement made about the morality of this story. I said at the end, there's a conversation. Yaakov says his thing. The brothers say their thing. Yaakov comments years later. How are we to assess it? There is shonim and divided. I want to claim that even the very biblical text itself is also throws us cues in all different directions, right? Because on the one hand, the language of the rape is very extreme. The language of the Navalah and Asheti Mei is very extreme. The sense of the opportunistic side of Shechem and Hamor is very extreme. On the other hand, you have the Mirma, you have all this language, Et Kol Bakarav, Et Kol Sonam, and they take it all. Maybe I'll say even more than that. We go back to the text of the Peret. What did they take? It says in Perek Lamed Hey, Pasuk Bet, "V'yom Yaakov beito v'kol hashemo hasiru et Elohei hanechar shebetochachem." Take away the foreign gods who are with you. V'itaru v'achlifu simlotechem. Change your garments. V'nakum v'nei beit El. Let's say Shem is be'ach le'el ha'onel tibyon sarati. We're going to do a korban. Put away your foreign gods. V'nu el Yaakov et kol Elohei hanechar shebiyadam v'et hamazamim shebozneihem. Where's all this stuff from? Rashi says, where do they get it from? Shechem! Right? Of course, what are the most valuable things in a city made out of gold or silver? Right? So you could say the truffle, right?
Yeah.
But it's likely that if they loot the city, what are the most valuable trinkets, right? They are the images that they took from the town. In other words, it could well be, they loot the town, but they also end up taking lots of gods. Which, of course, Yaakov says, right, we've got to put these aside before we go to Beit El.
Bloodshed moral outrage.
Sorry?
Kind of bloodshed moral outrage.
It's not necessarily moral, but Bnei Yaakov hanging out with Avodah Zarah.
Right. Right.
What is that? Okay. So what I'm saying is, even the text here is very, it's very, doesn't give us an immediate cue. I think it's very, very interesting that there is something so ambivalent about this parsha. It's almost as if we have two wrongs, and the question is how big they should exactly balance themselves out. This is what I find so fascinating about this parsha. And I'd like to give you maybe two perspectives in order to grapple a little bit with these, with this ambivalence. And the first perspective I'd like to share is that of Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. These are all comments. Sorry, the sheet's a bit in disorder. But if you take a look at Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch, he's commenting on Yaakov's statement in Vayechi, on his deathbed. always the question is, Yaakov issues a sort of moral statement on his deathbed. Why then? Some people will say it's very simple, you know, Al teratzeh adam b'shat ka'asor, right? Do not try and calm somebody down in their moment of anger. Do not try and, what is the same prayer about? Do not try and console somebody kasher meitom mutar afanav when their dead is before him. You know, Menachem Avel, before the burial. A person's morally agitated, emotionally agitated. You think he could talk sense into Shimon and Levi in this moment? He couldn't. So he wanted to wait till a later date. And of course, he wanted to wait till... Was there ever going to be a good time? There was never a good moment to tell them off, right? So, when could he tell them off? He waited and waited and waited, and then there wasn't, you know, he realized this, he had to say sometime. He ended up saying it on his deathbed, right? That's one possible. But it's still, what's going on here? Rav Hirsch wants to claim, Rav Hirsch points out that in the psukim here, Yaakov says, "Besodam al tavonashi, bikalam al techad kodi." When they're together, when they're in council, I will not be unified. I will not be a sense of calm. And he actually talks about achalkein be Yaakov v'afitzein be Yisrael. He says, "What's that word achalek? If I am mechalek an uga, I take a cake and I mechalek. Am I?" Afitzei means I'll scatter. It actually could mean to sort of obliterate and pulverize. But is a chalek, is that what it means? I will divide them up. Here Hirsch says, a chalkeim is to divide up. Not with the intention of breaking a hitherto whole, but rather to portion out something valuable. So that as many people as possible can have it. Afitzei b'Israel. On the other hand, to scatter, to divide up into the smaller possible pieces, so the whole no longer remains intact as such. What's he referring to? I'll just read a few lines of him. Now one answer, shall our treater be treated as a whore? HaChazonah Yaseh Tachotenu gives the whole motive. The local lord would never have allowed himself to act as he did, were it not a question of a foreign, friendless, forsaken jugo. That was the thought that brought home to the minds of Shimon and Levi that there are times when the family of Jacob too must grasp the sword to protect the purity and honor of their women. They have no desire to act prudently. They wanted to make themselves feared so nobody would attempt anything similar. The daughters of Jacob were not to be considered at anybody's disposal, but nevertheless, they went too far to take revenge on innocent people for that which the powerful ones had done. It is only the means which they took, and this is not by only, but it is only the means which they took, and they're going much too far in the use of them, that is blameworthy. The motive that moved Shimon and Levi, the purpose they were striving for, was a holy and most justified one. The spirit with which they were filled is an indispensable one for a family that had to wander about amongst the nations of the world, had to allow the bitterest fates to pass over them, and to endure the deepest degradation, and yet was to remain upstanding with all the elasticity of spirit and nobleness of mind, for their world's historic revival to an everlasting path through history, which is unparalleled. In other words, he's saying, Shimon and Levi represent a sense of Jewish pride. Too condensed, too concentrated, but sodam, but kahalam, it is a powder keg. It can explode. It is uncontrollable. It needs to be cursed. However, that essence should be divided up and distributed. That sense of Jewish pride has to be distributed and maybe diluted by 12, by 10. And therefore, spread it out. Don't let it be concentrated, but we need it. Achalkein. This is what he wants to claim. Maybe this explains why In Parashat Vayishlach, we hear that ringing line, HaChazonaya Setachotenu, because it represents a truth. But Yaakov also represents a truth, right? You can't take up arms and just massacre indiscriminately. If you're going to feel HaChazonaya Setachotenu, go through the law system, or kill Jashem, like the Ramban said, but don't kill indiscriminately. In other words, there's a point, it's a good point, but this is not the way, right? And therefore, this is how Rav Hirsch wants to relate to this. Another Rav Yehuda Shaviv lives in Alon Shavut, was a teacher in yeshiva for many years in Alon Shavut. And one of the powerful Rabbanim in Gush Emunim, in the early years of Gush Emunim, right? Gush Emunim, the settler of the movement. Nobody talks about Gush Emunim, but, you know, set up in, the late 60s, early 70s, Hanan Porat and others, and Rav Shaviv was one of them. He wrote this article in 1984. Maybe I'll give the background to the article in the end, but he says something very, very interesting. He says, Yaakov at the time felt exactly the ambivalence that we felt. They felt the stinging pain of this rape, the insult, the fear for the future. Yaakov, by the way, is always very, very fearful of what will happen to him. And Yaakov really felt intimidated and was worried that the family would not survive. On the other hand, when he didn't answer Shimon Levi back, on the one hand, they had it coming, and indeed. And he didn't comment at the time. Why did he comment later? Here I come back to what you were talking about before in Rashi. Ki ba'apam hirgu ish uvir tzonam ikrusho. Rashi says, who is the ish? Shechem. Who is the shor? Yosef. Right? Why is Yosef? Bechor shoro hadalo, it says in Sefer Devarim. Right? Yosef is the shor. Right? What else do we see the shor? Banot, what is it in Vayechi? The phrase used in the bracha of Yosef is... sorry, I'll find it in a second. Ben Porat Yosef, Ben Porat Aleayim, Benot Tzada Ale Shor. Right? The Shor is Yosef. As Shaviv says, at the time, Yaakov said, I don't love it. Right? They went too far, but okay, you know, I'm not going to start fighting with them. Anyway, look at this town, they all back their leader. You know, even talks the idea of the whole town, right? Defiling her, right? That phrase. But then, when does he realize it was so problematic? After the sale of Yosef. And by the way, you have to add in, according to this explanation, and according to Rashi, that he did find out about the sale of Yosef, which is debatable. But this is what the Rashi mentions that he's referring to, the sale of Yosef. In other words, at the time, he thought it might be justified. But after the sale of Yosef, when maybe Shimon and Levi, or maybe all the brothers can talk about, you know, let's kill our brother. He said, oh my goodness, you know, these chickens have come home to roost. I thought it was just going to affect those Shemites. But now it's in my own backyard. Now my own kids, they've become accustomed to murder. They've realized they can solve their problems through violence. Now they're in the family. Now Yosef is persona non grata. He's a threat. So now we'll just knock him off. I should have said something then. And now he uses very strong language. Arura pam kiyaz ve'efratam ki kashata al-chokem li'akov v'afitzem li'Israel. This has to be obliterated. This has to be scattered. This has to be pulverized. This is not something acceptable within our family. We don't kill. Right? By the way, to a certain degree, this is the story of Sefer Bereishit in many ways. You know, the first two brothers who rival, one kills the other one, and then we have the rivalry throughout Bereishit. It's only at the end of Sefer Bereishit that we see brothers being able to sort of get on and overcome their differences without killing each other or without ejecting somebody, right? In other words, in hindsight, he realizes that he really should have said something. And when did Rav Shaviv write this? So it's actually 1984. When did he write this? He wrote this after the death of, the murder of Emil Greenspan. If you remember, 1982, Israel go into Lebanon, and we all recall that terrible Rosh Hashanah, the Sabra Shatila, where there was huge demonstrations on the left, but as frequently happens when the left get into action and with call something morally reprehensible, the right don't feel that they want to raise their voices in that way. And a lot of people turned around and said, listen, even though, you know what I'm talking about, Sabra Shatila, right? Yeah. They said, look, you know what, it was Goyim killing Goyim, you know, and anyway they had it coming to them, and they're all terrorists anyway, and on the right there was a very low, whereas the left, they always talk about it as the largest demonstration in the history of Israel, where, you know, the newspapers said, people debate, but 400,000 people turned up in what was then Kikar Malchei Israel in Tel Aviv, to demonstrate and call for a commission of inquiry, which they did. Of course, that's also wonderfully ironic, because they decided that Ariel Sharon, who was the Minister of Defense, will never be allowed to be Minister of Defense ever again. They forgot to say also not Prime Minister, but they, you know, so he was never again the Minister of Defense, but he became the Prime Minister. But the right wing, and Rav Shaviv wanted to say, he didn't say it explicitly, but this was what was behind his article, right? Said, you know, let it go. And they weren't the ones who were calling for a condemnation. The very next year, the Shalom Achshav demonstration outside the Mishrad Rosh HaMashallah, somebody threw a grenade into the crowd, and a young Shalom Achshav activist, a guy called Emil Greenstein, was killed. And Rosh Hashanah was saying, look, you don't speak up. When the Goyim are killed, it might well come home to you. I think I feel this even more with events which I remember more closely. And Rav Lichtenstein spoke about this, and others have spoken about this, that people didn't talk up with a strong voice when Baruch Goldstein killed all those worshippers in the cave of Machpelah, when they said, "Oh yes, but he was mentally disturbed, emotionally disturbed because of all the people who were treated during the Intifada, and anyway, they were calling to kill the Jews and all these justifications," and there wasn't, with very few exceptions. By the way, actually, after Sabran Shatila, both Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital did write public letters. They were the lone voices. And I remember after that, I was in yeshiva then. And I used to go to visit my cousins, and my cousins would say, "Oh, you're in Amital's yeshiva." Right? Because the dead speak up in a so to speak, left-wing way. He lost his smicha. And the same thing happened after Baruch Goldstein. And then a year later, what do we find? Yigal Amir kills our prime minister. People said, and I think there's a certain truth, and this is what Rav Shaviv is pointing out. Rav Shaviv was not accused of any left-wing sympathies here, but you have to speak, you have to call out murder for what it is. You have to call out murder when you see it, because even if you think that there's some moral murkiness here, what goes around comes around, and it will visit back you. And it's only, Yaakov only realizes this in the end. And this is why I find...
He says
yes.
Lawless. He doesn't say murder, right? And all these examples that we're using are lawless.
Okay.
Right? I mean,
You're saying the language of Yaakov in...
Right, is lawless. And everything that you're talking about is lawless more than murder, I think.
He talks about Klei Hamas, right? I always think that the word is a powerful... You know, we remember with the flood. Vatim Aleha Aretz Hamas, right? Vayar... What does it say? Vayar Hashem Ki... It's at the end of Perek, at the end of Bereshit, right? The language there, sorry, I'll find it in a second. Vayomer Elohim Lenoach, Keitz kol basar ba'lefanai, ki malah haaretz chamas mipneihem, v'nim mashchitam et haaretz. I think chamas is a strong word. Maybe it is lawlessness, but it's lawlessness that turns to extreme violence, a lawless, violent society which you can't live in, right? Can you walk the streets at night? Can you let your daughters out without, you know, I don't know, South Africa, where they're afraid to stop at a red light because somebody will carjack them and steal from them. Lawlessness is it's deadly, right? So maybe the basis of safety is in law, making laws, but law enforcement, let's call it that way. So what I want to say is indeed, it's very interesting to, on the one hand, to read Rav Shmuel Hirsch, who says that the source of what's happening here is something very honourable, Jewish pride. On the other hand, to hear Rav Shaviv, who's saying that the source of the disparity, if you want, between Yaakov's comments then was a misunderstanding of how dangerous violence can sometimes be, and that it can sometimes, you know, increase and expand to something far more problematic. And to something which is almost addictive. And in this regard, I want to, if I've been dealing with the ambivalence in this topic, I think it really is ambivalent. I think it's a very dynamic and difficult topic, this topic of violence. I wanted to try and bring this into a convention. Start off by talking about the fact that Baruch Hashem, we are powerful in our generation. And I don't regret for a moment, I bless every day that we have Jewish power and we are able to defend our borders and our people. And as Rav Soloveitchik points out in his Kol Dedid Ofek, Dam Yehudi Eino Hefker, and that people are intimidated around the world, and they know that the long arm of the Israeli security forces will find them. And yet, the question is how. I think it's a question that many people are concerned about when their sons go in the army. On the one hand, they're very delighted when their sons go in the army. On the other hand, they're a little worried about what it might do to their soul. And if that's true on an individual or family basis, it's true on a sort of national basis. I want to just read two...
The question is, you know, for killing us, and they now have shown us killing.
Right? I want to be just two modern texts. And again, it's the right wing also on, sort of comes from Menachem Begin, the left wing comes from Rabin. But I have to say that in this particular case, I think that either of them could have said either of them. I don't think it's a... Maybe I've got to actually just sort of reverse the quotes and find the quotes of a left winger saying the Menachem Begin quote and a right winger. Because I really don't think... I think any classic Israeli leader would say both of these things. This is from The Revolt, Menachem Begin's book. If you're not familiar with it, it talks about the revolt against the British, the pre-state Irgun. And he says here, very interesting, he says... And by the way, it's quite interesting also... when you think about what he's saying, that this is the first story that happens after Yaakov had actually entered Eretz Yisrael. As I mentioned, the Balasa b'Yisrael, they're seeing themselves in a new guise, not just a family, you know, in another country, but this is, maybe they feel even a greater sense of entitlement, I don't know. But he says like this, a new generation grew up which had turned its back on fear. It began to fight instead of to plead. For nearly 2,000 years, the Jews as Jews had not borne arms. And it was on this complete disarmament, as much psychological as physical, that our oppressors calculated. They did not realize the two phenomena were interdependent. We gave out our arms when we were exiled from our country. With our return to the land of our fathers, our strength was restored. Blood too brought the revolt to life. The blood of our people cried out to us from foreign soil in which it had been shed, fired revolt in our hearts and gave the rebels strength. When the gruesome reports from Europe were confirmed, we knew that we must fight, not only for the freedom of our people, but for its very existence. Had we anything to lose? Right? You know, Hachazonaya set achotenu. It's sort of a rhetorical question. And this sense of Jewish empowerment, right? We are in our land, we have to, we cannot be pushed around in the same sort of language that Rav Hirsch spoke about, this, you know, this Jugo, right? Do you think you can push it in? On the other hand, I want to read Yitzhak Rabin's quote after the Six-Day War, which arguably may be our greatest, you know, military moment. I don't know if, you know, it could argue technically, but the mood in Israel was one of euphoria. And yet, he gets up after the Six-Day War at the celebration which they had on the Hebrew University and says, there is more to tell. The elation of victory had seized the whole nation, yet among the soldiers themselves, a curious phenomenon is to be observed. They cannot rejoice wholeheartedly. Their triumph is marred by grief and shock. And there are some who cannot rejoice at all. The men on the front line saw with their own eyes not only the glory of victory, but its cost. Their comrades fallen beside them soaked in blood, and I know the terrible price the enemy paid has also deeply moved many of our men. Is it because of their teaching, not their experience, has ever habituated the Jewish people to exult in conquest and victory, that they receive them with such mixed feelings? I think it said, has habituated the Jewish people not to exult. I think that's what he means. In other words, we don't celebrate our victories, right? We realize, you know, Maaseh Adai Tovim Bayam, Atem Omrim Shira, when people are dying, even if it's justifiable, it's not a moment for a carefree celebration. And therefore, we have, again, this sort of... ambivalence, which I think strikes all the way through, and I think maybe indeed this is the way it must be. Of course, there are some situations where there is chiyuv mita and there's a very much absolute, but a lot of these moral situations are murky. And what I guess I really want to say is, this tells me that we have to always keep our finger on the pulse, and we always have to be checking ourselves. Of course, we can use violence. Of course, we need to defend ourselves. Of course, this is, but. It is also in a too concentrated form, in an unchecked form, something very, very, very dangerous. And all of this ambivalence, both on the part of the Rishonim and both even in the Torah statements, and here that you see, I think leads us to, you know, what do we say? Handle with care. Handle with care. And therefore, when we have debates, like the debate that is going on in Israel about this Chayal Lior Azaria, right, who is on trial, and there have been people on the right wing saying, give him a break, you know, he was under a pressurized situation. You know what I'm talking about? The Chayal, yep. He was attacked, they was attacked by the by an armed Palestinian terrorist in Hebron, but then he was on the ground, and then he was shot by the Chayal. I'm not taking any sides here. He might have thought that the man moved. He might have thought that he had an explosive vest on, as the Chayal claims. In which case, He was acting absolutely in self-defense to save a disaster. On the other hand, he might have acted out of a sense of vengeance and against the laws of Tzahal, right? The thing which I reject is the call to say, why are you trying him? I think these debates are essential for our moral backbone. And that I'm proud that we are aware of this, that there is frequently a fine line between what is an act of self-defense and an act of even heroism and an act which is illicit. And to that degree, I'm very proud, and I hope that it will continue, that Israel will have this incredible sensitivity to know how to fight b'chol hakoach, and really to know how to fight b'chol hakoach, but at the same time, to always be checking ourselves to make sure that this doesn't overstep the line, because indeed, it can be very, very...
But it goes both ways. If you're checking too much and you're afraid to act,
too slow.
Then you can't act b'chol hakoach. I mean, for me, I think the point of you know, God, when Hashem Baruch Hu gave, you know, whether it's Yericho, or it's Yeridachat, you want to do something, you do a full job. And the point of it should have taken it is for Hashem, don't take the Ganachat Mosi, at least resonated with me. But maybe what they did, you know, you want to go, you know, take care of the problem, take care of the problem.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Shavua Tov, everybody.